Okay.
Okay, so we've got. Okay, we're ready to go, everybody. So where did we end up? Is it ready for?
The people were asking questions.
Okay, so people asking questions.
All right, folks. So I am back for, I don't know if I need to restate anything for the record. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know, just to make sure we're covering our public meeting records that I'm Stacey Jones, FPDR pension and finance manager. And we are discussing action item one, which is approving an FPD. Can you mute, Julie? That might help. We are approving, or we're discussing an FPDR two cost of living adjustment, action item number one. And we're asking if the board has any questions before we turn it over to public testimony.
And Julie's I think Trustee Kramer had asked a couple of questions, and I had asked one, wanting to verify what the assumption was for COLA increases for FPDR two in the most recent actuarial valuation. And I recollected, but I'm not 100% sure, that it was a 2% increase on service up to October 2013, and then something less, I think 1.75% for service after October 2013.
That is an excellent question, and I believe that is a really good question that I should have been prepared for. And I think you're right, Trustee McLeod, but I need to hop into our latest valuation and make sure. I think you're right. But let me hop in and make sure. And did you hear the answer to Trustees Kramer's questions? All the Zoom attendee or the remote attendees? Okay. Let me hop down to the end to our assumptions. Yes. So the assumption for COLAs for FPDR2s in the latest actuarial evaluation, which was as of June 30, 2022, was the blended average using 2% for service before October 8th, 2013, and 1.75% for service after that date.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions about the background material or what our options are for today from any of the trustees? Okay, so before discussion then, we go to comments.
Could you hold on just 1 second, Chair McLeod, I think. Trustee McLeod. I don't know, try it.
Check. Thank you.
Can you, Chair McLeod, could you hear Trustee McLowry when he just said the check?
I heard the check, but nothing before. If he was
okay, that's good.
Before. Okay.
We were just experimenting with their stations, which are different. Okay. All right. I think we're set. You can proceed, Chair McLeod.
Are there any other questions that someone would like to explore before we go to public comment?
No, thank you.
Okay, then I think we're open for comment.
Okay, now we have some public comment by Kevin Matches. Kevin, I'm gonna unmute you, and if you would like, I can share your presentation. Let me know.
Thank you, yes, I would appreciate the presentation.
Oh, I can barely hear you. One moment. Let's see if that worked better.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, appreciate the materials here. Thank you, I'm Kevin Matches. I'm here to address some questions raised by the board regarding inflation and cost of living adjustments. And just to elaborate on Trustee Kramer's question before, additionally, the FPDR2 members do not participate in Social Security. So they don't receive the cost of living adjustment that Social Security would normally provide either. But Charter gives the board the authority to grant COLAs up to a 2% cap. Actual inflation has far exceeded 2% recently. At the March 15, 2022 board meeting, Trustee Culp asked, is there a way to calculate how far behind inflation are the retirees? While it's difficult to answer that question about an entire population of retirees with various retirement dates, an easier way to address that question is to choose a single starting date, such as July 2020. For an FPDR2 member who was a retiree during the period July 2020 through February 2024, the inflation-adjusted value of their monthly benefit payment has declined by 11.2% over that same time period. Turning to the next slide, please. To translate that into a dollar value for a retired member's monthly benefit, you need to know what benefit they received in July 2020. In this hypothetical example, $6,280 is an arbitrary amount close to the average of FPDR2 retired members. In other words, some retired members had higher monthly benefit payments and some were lower. A member in this example would have seen their real monthly benefit payment decline cumulatively by 11.2% through February 2024. Consequently, the real value of their monthly benefit payment would have ended up at $5,578. What's important here is that this only took about 4 years to happen. Next slide. Another topic that has come up is the ability of the board to keep up with inflation over the long term by continuing to grant 2% COLAs in individual years when actual inflation might fall back below 2%. While it may be true that inflation has experienced short-term periods below 2%, this wasn't the case when you extended the time horizon out to 30 years, which is approximately the amount of time members are assumed to spend in retirement. This chart shows that long-term inflation did not fall to 2%. Turning to the next slide. I believe there is a way to successfully lift the 2% cap on COLAs. I'm proposing two concurrent policy changes. First, to replace the charter's 2% cap on COLAs with actual CPI inflation, conditioned on exceeding a specified funded ratio. Second, to adopt a comprehensive actuarial funding policy. By moving these two policy changes forward concurrently, the board will be able to give the COLAs they seem to want, and the long-term cost to taxpayers would go down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Matches. Any comments or discussion on what we just heard about?
Hey, Kevin, it's Chris Culp.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Hey, number one, thank you for the work on that. On that first slide, I would not have guessed that it was down over 11%. And to think that that's only over this very short period of time is eye-opening as well. On your last slide there, there's a lot of talk in there that I don't quite understand in regards to your second point. Can you explain a little bit on that second point?
The second point, so the cost of replacing the charter's 2% cap, is that...
Yes.
Or the number two, the cost savings of a change in policy.
The cost savings and the change of policy. How would that, if we raise these COLAs, how are you showing a savings to the fund in general? Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah. So the so replacing the cap of 2% on COLAs with actual CPI inflation, you know, under the actuary's current assumptions, that would increase costs. And so, you know, the board has discussed this in past meetings when this topic comes up, right? That it would be so hard to get that passed, you know, through council and through ballot measure, et cetera, because it means increasing costs.
True.
Without any kind of corresponding, you know, service that we could show to taxpayers. And so my proposal is that if you were to move forward that increase in the benefit policy with a change in the funding policy, the change in the funding policy would be how you achieve the cost savings. And so you just dedicate a tiny fraction of those long-term cost savings to this improvement in the COLA here.
That makes more sense to me now. I didn't catch that part initially. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's very illustrative to see over these past few years of very high inflation to see what the impact really has been. To bring it back into reality, our reality and this board's role, as I understand it, and please Sam or Lauren step in if I'm misstating something, our current authority does not extend to modifying the COLA for the maximum COLA of 2%, and it doesn't extend to changing the funding policy. So is that correct, Sam, Lauren?
No, that's correct. In fact, I believe, and Sam and Stacy could correct me on this, is I believe the 2% cap is imposed on FPDR by Oregon statutes. That even if we wanted to give a higher than 2% COLA, we could not.
Well, that would be important. Is that something that you might be able to investigate and verify for us?
Lauren, it's imposed in city. Well, do you mean because the PERS COLA is mandated by Oregon law?
I believe so. I believe that correct. under ETOB, I think under the statute that we're limited to giving a COLA that can't exceed the state COLA. No,
no.
Or is that a charter limitation?
Yeah. So there's language in the city charter that explicitly states that the FPDR board cannot give a COLA that exceeds the COLA that PERS awards a retiree, and the PERS COLA methodology is enshrined in state statute.
That's right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. So, but nonetheless, you know, both we understand, Mr. Matches, you've brought the proposal about beginning to pre-fund the tier one and tier two benefits to us on at least two prior occasions. And we know your earnestness about that. And it's interesting to have paired it with the potential for a COLA improvement. But again, those things we're limited. We really have no power over either of those two things. So as far as our responsibility goes, I think really all we could do is decide as a board whether we are interested in requesting any actuarial analysis on either of these things, or in turn encouraging the membership for police and fire to decide the importance for either of them to pursue these things and bring it to the council. Any discussion amongst the trustees about whether either in today's meeting or in a subsequent meeting, you want to discuss any informational analysis that we would share with others, but we could take no direct action on ourselves. Okay, I don't know if people are commenting and are on mute or if there's no expressed interest.
No expressed interest from the room here. I think everything has been said. And as far as I understand, are you also on the stage saying that the 2% max is through charter language? And if we were to able to through whatever methodology change that charter language, we could then disassociate with the state mandate, which is one of those frustrations I've mentioned in the past, the way the COLA is established. But we don't have the authority to change the charter language from the seat or any of the seats in this room.
Okay. So for now, I'm going to thank you for the presentation. And for now, perhaps move us back to our options for today with regard to this annual adjustment review, which, as Stacy pointed out, are to vote to approve the COLA increase today, and I'll open it up to recommendations, or that we decline to do it today, any COLA, or that we table it and request additional information and come back to it in May. So
I'll make the motion to just approve the 2% COLA across the board without trying to fluctuate these different percentages.
Second. I'm sorry, was that a second?
Point of order, we do need an effective date in the motion. July 1, 2024.
I'll make that motion and update it with July of 2024, July 1st of 2024.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Trustee McClary seconded. Yes.
Thank you. I'm hearing a lot of reverb, so it's hard to tell.
We all are.
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor signify by aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Hearing no opposes, that motion is passed.
All right. Thank you very much, board. I appreciate the decision. And I know that beneficiaries will appreciate being notified far in advance. So thank you very much for that. And we'll move on to the next item.
So the next action item is resolution number 552, administrative rule amendments to various sections that I won't state.
Okay. So we have two administrative rule changes we're proposing today under two separate resolutions. But before we get started on that, first of all, is everybody hearing me?
Yes.
Even online. Okay. We were going to pose a third change this time. It was going to be the definition of attending physician. We pulled that from now because we wanted to give our MCOs, managed care organizations, the opportunity to look at it because they're the ones that are going to have to hold the physicians in their plans to that. And we've had no negative feedback, but we didn't get their feedback in time to put it on this meeting agenda. So it will show up on the May agenda. So the first one we're looking at is resolution 552, which is approval of the definition or the change in the definition of spouse in the administrative rules. Julie, you want to pop that document up? FPDR reviewed the definition of spouse at the behest of Lisa Knight, a firefighter, when she raised her concerns back in January of 2023. She wanted to make sure that we could protect the definition of spouse in the FPDR plan from any potential changes that the Supreme Court could be making if they invalidate same-sex marriage. And basically, what we came up with this was there is no way to bulletproof our definition of spouse from the Supreme Court because we don't know what decision they're going to make or if or when they're going to make it. However, our definition right now fully complies with all state and federal laws, and it's very broad and allows protection of same-sex spouses and same-sex marriages. So we're very solid on that. And we had discussed that prior last November on that. So what we were doing when we were looking over the definition of spouses, Julie, can you move your mouse off that document?
Oh, yes.
We're getting a little pop-up on it. It's a spring bump office hours. Okay, maybe it's my screen. Okay, I apologize for that. And so as we are going through the administrative rules, we noticed we have definition of spouse and surviving spouse in seven different administrative rules. And we had seven different definitions of surviving spouse, and not all of them agreed to what was in the FPDR plan. So what you're looking at here in this document right now is the upper part of that document. It says charter, which is done by ordinance 186926 in December of 2014 at the behest of a law change at the federal level and at the state level of what the definition of surviving spouse and spouse should be. This is what's in the plan today. It's what we use today to administer claims and retirement pensions going forward. But we just, like, again, this definition was not in our administrative rules, and it doesn't make sense to have different definitions. You'll see that I've got two colors on this top part here. The blue color is the definition of surviving spouse, and the yellowish color is the definition of spouse with that. And so what we're looking to do, can you slide that document just a little bit more, Julie, so we can see the next section? Okay, well, shoot. Okay, move it back up to the top. I'm sorry, this is splitting pages, funny. So you'll notice here on the proposed change that is being in all seven administrative rules, we have the blue portion of that, which matches the language up in the definition that's in the plan. There, we've changed the word to make it a little bit more readable, but there's been no material change to that definition. And we've split the definitions into two parts, both the surviving spouse, which is in blue, and then spouse, which is in yellow. And actually, that's a green. What colors are those? Can't tell. I think it's green. And then there is a little blue part down here that you will see under the proposed change. And that refers to another plan or charter change that was made a few years before this definition. And we have to insert it. That covers domestic partnerships. They are part of the definition of surviving spouse. So we didn't change the wording materially at all. We've made it a little bit more readable. And then the same part here with spouse, it's a separate definition. It matches the yellow part above. And so all we've done for this, even though it's a big long one because we've changed so many of the so many different rules, is we brought the definition of spouse and surviving spouse in the administrative rules to match what is in the plan. No changes in substance, no change in anything with that. It was just to make it simple to read. And I think if Firefighter Knight had been looking in it and maybe shared some of these documents, that's where some of the confusion could have come from when they were looking at it initially. So what we're asking for in Resolution 552 is to approve the changes of the definition of spouse and surviving spouse to match what is in the FPDR plan as shown on this document. Any questions on that? Oh, and also I do want to say it was in the resolution. We did have a public hearing set aside. Nobody showed. So this didn't become an issue. Nobody put any writing. So there wasn't, I don't think this was controversial at all. It's more of I consider a housekeeping amendment.
I have two questions for you, Sam, if that's okay. Timely.
Go ahead.
The first one is, has this wording been run by council or cleared by council already?
The top part was, you'll see in this document, this was a council approved ordinance to comply with changes in law.
Sorry.
Okay, so that was done and that was approved in what, 2014, and there is an ordinance number at the top of that. So that is part of what we call the charter of the FPDR plan.
And you may have addressed this in your opening remarks. In 5.6, there was, it appears, a strange discordant definition of surviving spouse, which has been eliminated.
Yeah.
And that was because it never made any sense where it was.
Well, it made sense where it was, but the rules, administrative rules, are written starting in 2007. And so when they made these changes that were in 2014, not all the administrative rules are updated. It was an oversight. We changed some of them, but some of them were left at 2007 wording. And so that's why we're doing it, is we want to get all those definitions up to the current definition. So there isn't, so if I'm under this rule, I'm a spouse this way, but I'm not a spouse in this rule. So we want to clarify all that. This is the definite, we always follow what's in the plan, but the administrative rules didn't match and was confusing.
But let me see if I'm with you on this one small point, and that is, in 5.6, we've deleted the definition of surviving spouse and we haven't replaced it with anything.
It should,
and I assume that's because it isn't in fact relevant. I believe 5.6 relates to claim appeals.
And yeah, that may be because there were, I think in some of them is a good point on that. So what we did is we looked through every administrative rule that used the definition. You're correct. If it didn't use the definition, if the definition was in the definition section, but was never used in the follow-on section, we deleted it. So thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. You did catch that one. And I think you'll see maybe one or two of the others that you'll see the definition of spouse, not the definition of surviving spouse, because surviving spouse wasn't talked about in that rule. Good. Thank you. Good catch on that. I'd done this many months ago, so I've forgotten all the details. Okay.
And I have one clarifying question as well, just so I can understand. This language change is just in the administrative rules. This is not changing any like language cleanup in the charter itself.
No, the charter itself, like in that one document I showed you, was in 2014 in response to federal law changes.
Right.
And that was the guiding force. It just, unfortunately, when that passed, we should have immediately gone up and updated all the administrative rules, and that was not done. So 7 years after the fact, or 10 years after the fact, I'm coming through and cleaning up the administrative rules to match and make sure, as Tom brought out, do we need the definition for some of those rules? Because I don't use that term elsewhere in the administrative rule.
Makes sense. Thanks.
So again, just, you know, I've said a number of times, we are not changing the definition of spouse. That is locked into the charter by city ordinance due to federal law, and that's what we administer by. Okay.
Thank you for clarifying that. Any other questions or discussions about this? And if not, is there a motion to approve resolution number 552 as written?
So moved.
Do you have a second?
Second.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. The resolution passes with adoption. Thank you.
Okay. So we'll move on to the second administrative rule change. So this is under resolution 553. And I will thank Tom for being the cause of this rule administration change here. So we'll walk through what happened with this one. So what we want to do is bring, we're looking at citizen board members. Sorry, I got to get my volume down. Citizen board members. And there's a provision in that administrative rule saying that the auditor shall give the citizen trustee an oath of office when they are done. Tom, we didn't do it because what we had found out at the time was that the city council had removed that requirement from the city code. And so the city council says any member of any board of any commission in the city sponsored by any bureau or the city at large is no longer has to have the board members take an oath of office. So the auditor's office quit giving the oath. So we wanted to strike that one sentence out of here to say the auditor, they no longer have to take an oath of office. And that's all this rule does, just takes that out because the city and the auditor's office no longer do that.
That seems pretty straightforward. Thank you for explaining that. Any questions or discussion? All right, then. Motion to adopt resolution number 553.
I'll make the motion.
Looks like I get some of the cameras and stuff back up here in the room, so we're getting there.
Good. I think I heard a second, so all those in favor say aye.
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 Most. All right. Thank you. And I think that concludes our official action items for today. And that moves us on to information items. Sam, who's going to do information?
Kim is doing it. We're getting her set up on a laptop right now.
I thought that might be the case. Okay.
Working. Can you hear me? No, that is not Stacey Jones.
Yeah, that's not Stacey. We'll just pretend for today. So good afternoon, trustees. I'm Kimberly Mitchell, the FPDR Disability Claims Manager. And what I have for you today is just a brief update on the status of the Majorist contract. We have the exhibit that's in section one is the pricing agreement or contract that we are referring to today. But the brief update is just to let you know that we've done a lot of work. Let's see what happened. Okay, thank you, Julie. So we've done a lot of work. Majorist and FPDR have been meeting consistently over the past several months to just understand the individual program, how we work. We are very unique from their standard workers' compensation type programs, but we have come together and have agreed to the pricing, the deliverables, and terms of the contract. So we are right now pushing the contract through the process where procurement is involved, and what they're going to do is secure the signatures of the jurors. They're reviewing it right now. They're going to be signing the contract, and then they are also helping the procurement to update the professional liability and insurance policy information. And then after that, the contract will be afforded to the city attorney's office for their review. The chief procurement officer will review after that, and then the auditor's office. And so we've got a lot of hands in there, but they estimate that process is probably only going to take a couple weeks. Somewhere within that process, Sam will be signing the contract as well. So once we do that, we will be ready to move forward. And what we've been doing in the interim is we have just been preparing. We've been doing a lot of strict training between Majoris and my staff for them to understand our program better and for us to understand their processes. We've also been flagging claims for enrollment and preparing letters and forms, information that our membership will need once we're able to roll the contract out and get it implemented. And so a lot of work behind the scenes, but we are at a place where I'm feeling good that we're going to be able to move forward. And so I think that's all I have to share about the status of it. Do you have any questions about the materials you've received?
I have just some procedural questions. If we just look at the first page, for example, the second paragraph, there is a couple of numbers in parentheses in a lighter font, and those sorts of numbers appear throughout the contract. What do those numbers mean?
The first page of the contract.
At the end of the second paragraph, for example, it's 11/20.
Good question.
And then in the numbered paragraphs, they appear essentially with respect to at the beginning of each paragraph.
Those are revision dates for the contract. The template that procurement gives you.
Thank you, Stacy. I don't do these often, but we think that they are the revision dates for the template that the city uses. We all use a template and work from that to create our contracts.
Some of them going back significant years.
Yes.
I think those will be removed on the final because really what we've.
And even pay attention to this every
18. Oh, you don't think it's 2020.
So those types of things will be removed going forward because what the work Kim has done on what she's showing you here is what it does is the hard work has been done. All the staff at Majoris agrees to this agreement, so do the FPDR staff. Now it's got to go through all the little attorneys have got to look at it, see if they like the little things in it. So the bulk and the statement of work, the pricing is all agreed to here. It's just a matter of everybody dotting I's and crossing T's moving forward. I'm certain that's one of the ones that will be taken out before it gets signed or those things there. We'll double check on that because those, I think, are just placeholders on the what we have done. But you know, do want to thank Kim for doing a tremendous amount of work getting us to this way because EMS. Majoris is new to us. The city's been doing, but they're sort of new and working into some of the workers' compensation stuff. They're a larger regional company. So they are sort of set in their ways of how things have to be done. And we are a unique plan. So it took a lot of discussion back and forth. We never got opposition from Majoris. It was just, we all had to understand what each other was doing and what we were expecting as a result. And that took a lot of time. And I do want to thank Kim for that. So now it just goes through this last series of dotting I's, crossing T's. Are all their attorneys happy with our attorneys have it. Insurance people are happy with it. And then it just goes through that process. And when it gets started that we are 95% of the way there. I've only had twice that we've had to come back based on that and get some stuff fixed, but none of those have been major. So again, Kim has done all the work to get it here. And so this document is going to go through unless, again, all the people that dot I's and cross T's have some questions.
I have two more along the similar lines, if that's all right.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I suspect what you just said covered in Exhibit D at the very end. We have some a blank and some redlined material. Mm-hmm. Same, just to be finalized in a final version. And then this may have been answered by what you explained about the numbered clauses. Has legal or procurement already had some involvement in the sense of we're using their boilerplate clauses, or they've given us an outline or something that makes us think we'll be able to get it through them quickly?
Yes, the procurement has a boilerplate contract that we've piggybacked on and is something that they used with City Risk, who has a similar contract. And so all the boilerplate language that was questionable has been worked out, which is why we wanted to piggyback on that a little bit to save some time on the back end.
Thank you.
I just have one question. It's been a while
yes.
since we've talked about this. Can you remind me who's providing these services currently? Is this all internal staff?
Good question. Yes. Currently, staff is doing that internally for those who, members who are not enrolled in an MCO. And what we've adopted were procedures for pre-certification, similar to what the managed care organizations have used. It's not as detailed, but we have been able to continue the pre-certifications of all the treatments our members have needed through this process. But we want to hand that off to the MCOs.
Okay, understood. Thank you. Any other questions? For Kim? All right, thank you very much. Appreciate the update.
Yes. Yeah, and Catherine, I'm sorry, were you asking whether or not they were replacing MHN?
No, I was wondering who was, I knew that contract had ended, and I just wanted to know how it was being handled in the interim.
Yes.
So obviously there's training going on, but the contract hasn't been executed, so.
Correct.
You know. The services still need to be provided. I assumed it was staff, but thanks for confirming.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I believe the next item is for Lorne, if that's correct, on the actuarial standard of practice update, or Sam, are you going to start that off?
That's up to Lauren.
Okay, no, I'll take it. All right, so as most of you are aware, over the past several months, there have been discussions concerning whether relatively new actuarial standards of practice number 4, ASOP 4, might impose new requirements on Milliman when performing the various projects that Milliman is performing for the fund. We, in concert with the actuaries, have previously reviewed ASOP 4 as well as the service agreement between the fund and Milliman and concluded that it sure didn't look to us like ASOP 4 would impose things like funding assumptions, funding reports, basically our conclusion was that the new rules requiring enhanced disclosures only applied to the extent the work Milliman was performing for the fund constituted a funding valuation. Our view was that it didn't appear like it was a funding valuation within the meaning of ASOP 4, and therefore the contract with Milliman was sufficient. But in further discussions, we agreed that since the kind of final arbiter on what ASOP 4 means, one rests with the actuaries and their own standards boards, and two, it's really up to Milliman to sort of self-police whether or not they're doing things in accordance with their own requirements imposed on them by the actuarial standards board. That it would make sense for Milliman to reach out to the actuarial board on counseling and discipline, the ABCD, which is the body within the actuarial standards board that would be the one to decide whether or not the reports as they've been historically performed would satisfy the requirements ASOP 4. So Milliman reached out to the ABCD, spoke with someone on the ABCD with familiarity with ASOP 4, had a lengthy discussion with them concerning the nature of the services that Milliman has been and is expected to in the future render to FPD&R. And on the basis of those discussions, the individual with the ABCD concluded that it didn't appear to him that the work implicated anything that would make their work treated as funding valuations under ASOP 4, and therefore Milliman would not have to prepare those additional reports that are now required under ASOP 4 for any funding valuation. Now, a couple things there. Since this was not raised as a formal complaint, this was really just Milliman seeking advice from the ABCD as to their informal conclusions as to whether or not the work Milliman is performing for the fund is a funding valuation. Again, the response they got back was really informal. They don't typically issue written formal opinions unless the issue is something they think is going to come up again and again and again. Given the uniqueness of FBDNR as a pay-as-you-go system, it's unlikely that they're going to get a whole lot of questions involving similarly situated projects being performed by actuaries. So, well, you know, you never know, never say never. It could be that the ABCD could at some point issue a formal opinion on things like this. It seems unlikely. And so Milliman's position is they are, based on that conversation, they are comfortable that none of the work they're being asked to provide, it constitutes a funding valuation. So they're going to proceed accordingly with respect to the service agreement with the FPDNR. They are not going to develop any sort of funding valuations. They're not going to develop any reports relating to contributions that you know, might be required if the fund was subject to any contribution requirements. I guess one last thing is that the individual that they spoke to at ABCD did indicate that he would be socializing the nature of the conversation they had with Milliman, as well as the informal guidance that this individual had provided to Milliman, to his colleagues on the ABCD, and if there were any significant disputes or questions that arose after that advice had been given, they would reach back out to Milliman to let Milliman know that maybe the answer they gave wasn't as solid as it seemed, and maybe there'd be some further discussions. But subsequent to those discussions with Milliman, they have not heard anything back from that individual with the ABCD. So Milliman is, again, comfortable proceeding as though no funding valuation concerns have been implicated. And so they're just going to move on and perform the work as agreed to in the service agreement. Any questions?
No, I have no questions, but I appreciate that well thought out summary of the situation. It's kind of complicated to follow,
right.
But I appreciate it. How nice that you summarized that. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ken. If there are any other questions, again, if the ABCD that does come back to Milliman, I've asked Milliman to let me know immediately, and I'll advise the fund and the board of trustees so that they're aware of if there's any questions at all about any other interpretations of ASOP 4 and its application to the work Milliman's providing for the FPDR.
Okay, thank you. And again, I'd like to just help put this back in the context of where this question first came up. It related again to some discussion we had earlier today about the advisability or suggestion about pre-funding the Tier 1 and Tier 2 FPDNR benefits, and discussion about the potential long-term savings of doing that juxtaposed against the cost to current taxpayers of doing so. But that's where it came up in discussion. But the reality, again, is grounded in the fact that this is not a decision that this board has any control over. Really, the extent of our involvement would be if any of the trustees felt very strongly that that would be information about pre-funding that would be helpful to have to assess and analyze and perhaps pass along to council or the public that would be, as I understand it, our role. We could do that if we chose to spend the money to do that out of our budget to do that.
I think that's right. I mean, I guess what I would say is that, you know, earlier you said that, you know, the funding is baked into the charter, and under the pursuant to the charter, we use a pay-as-you-go funding approach that relies heavily on the property tax levy. So right now, and I mean, it's been this way apparently since like 1948 or thereabouts, the fund has always been viewed as funded through pay-as-you-go. If ASOP 4 had said that the work Milliman is currently doing, even though it's a pay-as-you-go type valuation, that, you know, if either that valuation was a funding valuation or the additional work that Milliman's doing regarding adequacy of the property tax levy to for the city to be able to rely on as a method to pay the benefits, if either of those had met the definition of funding valuation under ASOP 4, that would require Milliman, pursuant to its own professional standards, to, in addition to the normal reports that Milliman has been providing to the board, to provide some additional reports that would apply to plans like PERS that actually are funded. And so when PERS gets an actuarial report, you know, there has to be a funding policy because that's funded, and there has to be some sort of a report on the required level of contributions that would be necessary to enable the plan to satisfy its funding assumptions. Here, if that were to happen, Milliman would have to prepare a bunch of ancillary reports, which would be of little use to the fund, because irrespective of whatever reports Milliman was required to generate under ASOP 4, again, the question of whether or not the plan is to be funded or pre-funded or not is a decision that this body doesn't have the power to make. But it would require, nevertheless, Milliman to prepare these extra reports. So that's kind of what we've been focusing on, is does Milliman have to do these extra reports, even though the fund, even though the FPDR is not, doesn't actually have pre-funding. And the ASB or the ABCD has said, no, you don't need to do that, since the work that they're doing doesn't really make sense for them to do that. But again, even if they did it, even if they said ASOP 4 requires these reports, that in and of itself would not require the plan to be funded on a pre-funded basis. It would just mean that Milliman would have to prepare these extra reports that, again, in my view, were effectively meaningless given the fact that the plan is actually not pre-funded. Anyway, it's kind of like counting angels on the heads of pins, but I guess the key is that Milliman is comfortable that they don't need to worry about this.
Yes, and that we can be comfortable that our contractual agreement with Milliman covers services that should be provided on behalf of the plan.
That's right.
We're in good shape. So I think, unless there's other questions, that we can consider that resolved. And again, if any of the trustees in the future think that there is significant value in us engaging Milliman to do this work optionally on behalf of the plan in order for us to share it with other bodies or groups informationally in order to encourage, you know, the council or someone else to make a decision about this, that's our option for the future. So I'm assuming that that's not on the table for now, but if someone is interested in that for a future board meeting topic, let us know. Okay, I think any other discussion on that topic? Okay, thank you, Lauren. All right, item number three is a follow-up to questions about the FPDNR versus PERS pension comparison from our January meeting.
Did you want to bring up what you talked with me before?
Sure. I spoke to Sam a little bit about this prior to the meeting offline, and that comparison was largely brought about by something that I was interested in. And I think that there was a little bit of a miscommunication between us. And what Sam brought forth was a comparison between the FPDR disability and the PERS disability plan. And I was more interested in trying to put a, and that's obviously from the, what we told us, a very different and almost not even worth comparing the two plans. I was more interested in comparison between the FPDR disability and the state workers' comp. I don't think I was as clear when I actually, prior to that, toward the last meeting, I didn't know there was a portion of PERS that was disability. All the agencies that I'm aware of that I interact with from a fireside, they all have the PERS and they have workers' comp for the disability. So that was a miscommunication. And I think more of what I was interested in is trying to get a sense of this comparison, similarities, and differences between my disability plan and the state workers' comp plan. So that's something we can maybe talk about offline later, Sam, or we can maybe talk about in a future meeting.
So thank you, Kyle. What precipitated that presentation was more to address issues that Joe Jimkowski and Del Stevens had brought forward, that PERS had a disability plan, and that the feeling that was presented by them was that the PERS disability plan was richer than FPDR. So when I looked at it, I was there more responding to the positions that Del Stevens and Joe Jimkowski
had repeatedly made to the board over the past 10 to 15 years.
I thought, let's go through. So that's why I focused on the PERS, because there were some statements being made that the PERS was richer. And even with finding with the taxes, it wasn't. So that was the point forward. So I apologize for any confusion. It wasn't for the comparison.
Comp between state and FPDR.
And I will say that I found that presentation to be particularly helpful. And it was also insightful because I think in that analysis, there was some discussion about the taxability of a portion of the benefits that might be now non-taxable that, you know, we weren't aware of before. But Trustee McClary, are you feeling then that you would like to have a presentation on the state workers' comp versus FPVNR workers, you know, disability benefits?
Can you mute that real quick? Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to be anything particularly formal. I think that prior to us trying to put it onto a future agenda item, I'd be willing to just maybe communicate with Sam directly, just sort of get some basic information so we can be more clear and precise with the comparison. Doesn't have to be a huge amount of work, something that can be even more directed towards the specifics that maybe relate to FPDR. So I'm happy to go down that road so we can just sort of far into it right now, and that Sam and I can talk about it, maybe bring it forward in the next meeting to try and figure out when that might work on a future agenda.
That would be great.
Does that work for you?
It does.
Yeah. One thing that I can do for you, I forwarded a while back, but around 2007, there was a lot of analysis done by unions on comparing the two plans, because there was at the time of 2007, a lot of recommendation at that time, not only creating FPDR-3, but to move FPDR disability into the workers' compensation, state workers' compensation system. The unions and even FPDR did some comparisons between the two high level. And I think the most telling is that Bennett Hartman, who did the study, who represents, I think, FIRE right now, they did the study and They had no recommendations to move it. They felt, and I've talked with Nelson, the FPDR plan is richer than the state workers' compensation plan. So we can come back and share those documents. We'll go back and find those old documents
that would be used to compare workers' comp at that time, and those are high level.
I think what we've talked about is for a full, complete comparison, it's pretty complex because workers' comp does things differently than we do.
how they make benefits, how they define permanent, partial, permanent, total.
There's a lot of difference in that. But I think the high level overview, I think coming from what was analysis done back about 2007, I can share with you. And then if we want to do further, we can talk about it for a further meeting, what further that would meeting. Entail.
Are you referring to the work that was done during the FPDR reform committee or after the committee, after the reform went into action?
I think there was some analysis. I don't think it was formal. I think it was done in reply to that. What we'll do, because I'm going to talk about what we've done for giving more documents on the reform committee. I will look at just specifically for the workers' comp.
I think I did in the casting, and I'll reshare them with you.
It gives you an overview of what the thinking was at the time.
Okay.
The concern that I have for comparing workers' comp, the FPDR, and the state is that it's like comparing an apple to a elephant. There are so many differences in the plan, it's hard to do it. If you can take some straightforward situations, you can do it, which is, I think, what the attorney's firms had done and FPDR had done at the time. The challenge we had is the auditor office did their own review, and they came out and said,
we're so far ahead, and they made some mistakes in their analysis. With it too, and they ignored some of the counter benefits to FPDR.
So we'll do that, see how far to go.
I think the concern that Kim and I have, if I want to compare, is I'm going to have to have probably a third party do that comparison for you
because of the complexity of the two plans, really what compares and doesn't compare with it. I mean, so we can look at that. So let me share that stuff with you, and then after you have more discussion at future board meeting. And see where in direction you want to go and understand it. And just always remember that if at any time the membership believes that they want to move, that workers' comp is better than FPDR, the members can vote to move to workers' comp, but a majority of all members. That's in the charter, section 5403. I can't remember the exact number, but it's in section 5403.
Okay.
So if everybody wants to do their own analysis and they can convince half the active members that they want to move it, they can.
I will tell you that it would still be administered probably by FPDR. Or maybe risk would do it, but all the funding and all the costs would still come after FPDR, even if it was moved under that plan. So it wouldn't take away.
It wouldn't cost us any less or more.
So I'll get you that information out and then more follow-up with that. Okay. I'll just go ahead and jump again, Catherine, because I'm on the next couple things. So I'll just keep on running through. So the next thing that we had, well, are we done with that one? I'm sorry, Catherine, I'm sort of done with that topic. Okay, getting some nods, yes, I apologize. Yep. So a legislative update, this was a short session that lasted for a couple months, and it did end on March 10th, so just a couple weeks ago. There were two bills that are of interest to FPDNR that went through. The first one is House Bill 4117. This is a follow-up bill to House Bill 2805 from the 2023 legislature. 2805 clarified the definition of a public meeting. We had talked about what an electronic meeting is and electronic sharing of information. It also empowered the Oregon Government Ethics Commission to conduct investigations, make findings, and impose penalties for organizations that do not comply with public meeting law. House Bill 4117, which was passed this session, allows the commission to give advice on public meeting law. It authorizes them to issue advisory opinions on the application of public meeting laws to actual and hypothetical situations. The advantage of this is that now if we or any public entity is not certain, are we doing this correctly? Are we bypassing or not following public meeting law? You'd have to wait until somebody filed a complaint and you go through the complaint process. Now what HB 4117 says that the commission can give you advice up front. So you give them the situation. Are we in compliance? Are we not in compliance? Or gee, maybe if we did this in the future, would that be in compliance? So it removes that gotcha approach to where you can only find out if you're not doing it right until somebody files a complaint and you get sanctioned for it. So I'm not certain we will avail ourselves of that, but I think that was a good motion, because a lot of times when they pass these laws, it's what I call the gotcha, is how you figure out if you're in compliance. The second one is 4045, more changes to PERS. There always seems to be some PERS changes coming through. This bill had some changes. A lot of it was defining who's a member and what class that member is in and what kind of benefits that class gets. So let me walk you through this. Prior to the passage of this bill, PERS had two classes of employees, general service, police, and fire. Pretty obvious of who's in that. But there's been a lot of concern that maybe there are other jobs throughout the state that are hazardous types of jobs, or where people are in intense jobs that cause a lot of stress or a chance for either mental or physical ailments coming from that. And so they added a third class this year, and that was hazardous positions. For the city of Portland, where it's important is this includes 911 operators and dispatchers, everybody that works on our emergency communications. This does not impact FPDR, but is a significant change to PERS, creating this third level, and addresses the issue where everybody else is trying to say, well, we want somebody to get more than general service, so the only option is we're going to call them a police officer, even though they're not a police officer. We saw a lot of crazy things out there, still see it in the statute of calling certain positions police officers that aren't. So they said, okay, hazardous positions, so you put this in there. And again, for the city of Portland, it'll be the emergency communications staff. The second part, which does impact FPDR, is that under OPSERP, the retirement age was age 60 for police and fire, which is higher than it was for PERS Tier 1 and Tiers 2. This lowers the OPSERP retirement age to 55. So it's down to matches pretty much what's Tier 1 and Tier 2. And that goes into effect for anybody whose date of retirement is on or after the effective date of the act, which is January 1 of 2025. It will have a financial impact to us to some extent, so I've asked Stacy to go over that with you.
So it is a little hard to know exactly what the financial impact will be. But you can see the LFO, the Legislative Fiscal Office, and their impact, think it likely, as do all municipalities, that all things being equal, that will increase PERS contribution rates. You kind of have two effects going on. You have one is that folks can retire earlier. So that means PERS will pay them for longer. The other effect is that it does somewhat reduce their benefit, because part of the calculation is years of service. So that means you pay them less, but for longer. But the actuaries know that the push-pull doesn't perfectly offset, and that in general, you're going to pay people out a little bit more. And that's because to retire at age 55, you have to have 25 years of service, I believe. Is that right? For PERS. Wait, no, I'll just pull up the bill, right? So maybe that's not a good explanation of why that push-pull happens. So I'm sorry, you can go at 53 if you have 25 years of service, 55 if you don't. But they do pull in and assume that almost the people have pretty close to the maximum years of service, like looking at the LFO analysis. So they expect a slight cost increase, which will, all things being equal, result in an increase in PERS contributions for all municipalities that employ police and fire, which of course includes the city of Portland, and those are funded by FPDR fund. But that's all things being equal. Lots of things roll into contribution rates. We will, Milliman will try to pull them apart for us when they go in and reset those things. But, investment earnings go into those things and all kinds of things. But all things being equal, it will increase costs. It'll increase contribution rates. We're part of a rate pool at the city. We're part of the SCLRP, the state and local government rate pool. So setting PERS contributions rates is complicated. But all things being equal, it will increase PERS contribution rates. Or everyone expects it to, and we'll see how it actually plays out.
Part of that push-pull, though, concurrently, you maybe have higher employer rates or PERS rates for the people who are currently employed, but people would be leaving earlier, so less costs for those rates as people are walking out at 55 instead of 57 or 60.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite following.
You're not gonna, when people are leaving earlier, you're not paying those. You're not paying for them anymore.
We'll be able to hire somebody new, right?
You do, yeah.
And you have to pay those.
It's a percentage of the salary, correct?
Right.
Yeah, so it's a...
Well, and that's just in the... that's sort of in your like your workforce demographic model. I think there'll be like a brief impact that you'll see if we do shift retirement age down. And I was thinking, and the other thing we should mention is the impact to the police and fire bureaus as they operate. You know, they'll get a lower return on their investment if folks do retire more quickly because in terms of training because people won't serve as long as they once did. So for them, it's a lower ROI on people in that sense. And you'll also see that sort of impact right away where maybe a lot of people retire earlier than they expected, but then you just shift your whole model and be, you know, now it's just a shorter model. You just have a shorter life cycle for your employees. And you bring people in, you know, when you hire them there, you know, they take 4 years to top out at fire and 8 years to top out at police. And
I think it's five for fire.
Is it five for fire? Yeah. And a longer time at police. And so you shift that whole model down, but.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it is, you know, I would have to defer to people who are more expert at costing those things than I am. But that is the general belief is that all things being equal, it increases contribution rates, but there are many things that play into PERS contribution rates. But this is one of the things that will likely increase contribution rates.
Did you say that this goes into effect for people hired on or after January 1,
2025? No, people who are eligible to retire January 1st, 2025 or later. So this will have
all current members, assuming they, okay.
At the city of Portland, we don't have a lot of PERS covered members who will be eligible to retire on January 1st, 2025, because we just started hiring PERS covered members in 2007. There are some, you know, who came in as laterals who had pre-existing PERS service, but operationally, this will more immediately impact other municipalities and the state police and places like that. It'll impact us immediately in rates because we're part of that SLRP pool, which right now feels like not such a great deal. But it will impact us operationally more in the future than it will now.
Can you tell me what was the name of that bill? Was 4045?
It was House Bill 4157.
4045. House Bill 4045.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Sam.
Yes.
Do any of those changes affect the ETOB test with Peer 2 or with FPNR2 folks with those dates being 53 and 55? Doesn't affect us in any way, right?
I don't think it would with us on top.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And Sam, the bill is HB 4157, right? Look. I believe it's 4157, just to make sure that Chair McLeod has the right bill number.
Okay.
Yeah, too many bill numbers. Anyway, someone will figure that out, just to be sure. I don't think so because Trustee Culp, we're still at, for us, it's 25, it's 55, and then age 50 with 25 years of service. So we still have, you know, better eligibility requirements.
It is House Bill 4045.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think part of the advantage is that we're thinking some of the first retirees that will come under this will be in their mid 2030s, you know, that were hired under at 2007. So it gives both the fire bureau and the police bureau time to adapt their model, staffing models, as Stacy was talking. So it's not going to be all of a sudden next week or next year we're going to see a big change, because I think you'll be impacted, as Stacy said, for a short period of time as a lot of people retire earlier than they would have, but that's not going to happen. I think you'll have plenty of time for the bureaus to do their staffing models going forward.
Any
And then next year, starting in February, we will have the 6 month long legislative session. Every other year it's long, so it'll be there. I do expect to see workers' compensation bills, PERS bills, and other bills, and I'll be pouring through all those as we go through. And I'll talk a little bit more. I'm hoping that I can get a bill for workers' comp, or actually for public records, put through, and I'll go more into that later after I get a chance to talk to government relations to see if it's got a snowball's chance of going through.
Okay, thank you very much. Next item is summary of expenditures. I take it that's Stacy.
Yeah, too much noteworthy to say. I suppose if you look at the second to last line, you will see that we paid off our tax anticipation notes in January. As you all know, because I won't stop talking about it, I've been nervous about the interest arbitrage split. So I've been wanting to pay those off earlier in the year than we have in the past. So we did go ahead and pay those off in January. So you see that money going out the door. Another slightly interesting thing to note is up in revenues, up in miscellaneous sources, which is about the fourth line down, that's mostly interest income. And you can see that we're finally getting some because we have money again. So that's what's happening in, you know, December and January, is that we have some interest income coming in. A slightly noteworthy item is in external materials and services, which is in the middle of the table under, my copy is so, let me look at the one on the screen. Under internal materials and services, FPDR3 pension contributions, those are what we were just talking about, where we reimburse police and fire for those pension contributions. You can just see zeros all the way across. Because police and fire still hadn't billed us for any contributions. They did get quarters one and two in February. I just wanted to reassure you. They hadn't closed February. I don't know why I need to reassure you. I should really be reassuring the general fund. But that money did get over into the general fund in February. You just can't see it here. This has recently come to the mayor's attention. So maybe this will get resolved and they'll get this money moved over more quickly. I've been advocating for an automatic process, but not with much luck. We'll see. Are there any questions about the expenditure?
Thank you. Right. Sam, you're going to cover FPDR updates.
Yes, FPDR updates here. So as we said earlier, we will have in May the administrative rules for definition of attending physician. The timeline for that is we'll post those rules publicly on April 26. We'll hold a public Q&A session the week of May 6. We'll time and date to be determined. And then the board will evaluate and approve the rules if they desire at the board meeting on May 28, 2024. We'll bring forward those. You'll have a chance to read those ahead of time. And you can ask us any questions before the meeting, and then we'll answer them while you evaluate those rules. I imagine there may be some public Q&A participation, because I do think it would be more positive because we're adding, we're expanding the definition and covering more different types of practitioners under that. So I think it will be seen as a positive. Trustee elections. So Kyle and Christopher, you all are being, your positions are up for election this fall or this December. The election process starts on October and is run by Julie Hall. The process is outlined in the administrative rules of 5204A3, because this is a vote by mail. So the rules are pretty detailed on the process. We will go over this process in more detail with you at September board meeting, because as the work will start on the election, we'll start in October. And if you have any questions beforehand, let us know. Julie and I will be happy to walk you through the processes at that point. 2000 charter reform. I think Kyle, a long time ago, you had asked, gee, could we get more information on the charter reform and documents? I think various people have tried to get public records and have different aspects of that. I asked Julie Hall to do a big research project to try to find all board materials relating to the 2007 charter reform. And she has done it. We have something like 30 different documents totaling almost 400 pages long with it. I think it's a comprehensive amount of it. And we will post that. We're going to set you up with a website but a folder that you all can come into and pull the reports from and the documents. It's a lot of reading, but I know a lot of people have questions. And we've tried to make it as complete as possible, because I know people have been able to find certain of those reports, but this is as comprehensive as we could get. And so just to let you know a little bit on that process on the 2007 charter reform. It was spearheaded by Commissioner Saltzman. He was the commissioner in charge at that time of the FPDNR. He ran it through with city council. City council assigned or approved and assigned the committees that reviewed the FPDR plan. The FPDR board's only role was to participate in providing input. They had no decision making and they input, so they did not drive the process. They were just sort of a stakeholder in the process as it went through. And so you'll be able to see all the documents there, all the committees, all the resolutions, all the committee reports on that. So you'll have fun reading through it, see how much. And I think we're also going to include probably 30 to 40 different Oregonian newspaper articles that sort of led up to why some of this stuff happened. You can see what was out in the press and what the public was seeing and where some of the pressure was coming from behind the scenes politically to do something about it. About the plan and why they wanted to do the reform. So be looking forward to that. We'll get that out to you in a few weeks here with links to the folder, and it's a secure folder.
Quick question for you, Julie. Were you able to find any of the city council work sessions where they talked about reform, the videos?
The videos?
Yeah.
I'll look, but I don't.
If you have trouble, I think I might have copies. If you want, I can send them to you.
Yeah. Fortunately, a lot of this stuff is required to be saved, but the city does not have a retention time period for the videos. So the videos tend to have dropped off or out of it. So I mean, anything you can contribute to that, okay, would be glad to add to
that. I think we have it archived at Local 43.
Okay. It'll be interesting to compare what you all have in an archive versus what we're able to find through all of our searches of the reports. Jump over to the last meeting topic here today is future meeting, future agenda items. So for the May 28 board meeting, we have tax anticipation notes. You know, Stacy just said we paid them off. Well, we're going to have to start gearing up to issue them again. And there's a process to go through, and we need your approval to do that. And Stacy will explain the whole process as she usually does. We will also do the administrative rule change for the definition of the attending physician. We have no informational items scheduled at this time, but we'll go down to a list here in a minute of informational items that you had put on a future meeting topic list. The July 23-24 meeting, we have no topics of any kind, which is not uncommon for July. I think about half the time we cancel that meeting if we don't have topics, but we always hold it in place. We usually make the decision not to hold it toward the mid-June. So if anything comes up, we don't cancel it too quick. September 24, 2024, we'll do the state of FPDR, and we'll also go into more review of the process for the election of the police and fire trustees. Now the future meeting topic list, which I've been keeping up, is was a discussion of forming a committee to review the FPDR 2 pension plan. The second one is discussion on doing a study comparing the FPDR disability program to the Oregon Workers' Comp program. Then also the strategic plan review for FPDR, and at some point review the Board of Trustees handbook in more depth if you want to. So I'm looking for the May 28th, again, tax anticipation notes, administrative rule changes,
and items. So is there anything you're up and you bring up and you can add,
kind of all the way up until about 2 weeks before we have to formalize the schedule. Okay. I see head nods negative here, Chris and Catherine. Okay, head nods there. Okay.
Sam, I did just want to mention one thing about the May meeting and tax anticipation notes. There is a small, but not impossible,
probability.
Anyway, there's a possibility that I would bring forward a recommendation to borrow money from another fund at the city this year that the debt manager and I've been talking about, which, you know the option there is that we will not make any money, but nor will we lose any money. And that may be something that we want to pursue as a risk management strategy this year. So just to give you a heads up that there is a chance it will not be the normal tax anticipation. Instead, you'd be authorizing a fund transfer, probably from the sewer or water operating fund.
And there are two other topics which I would insert under FPDR updates when they come up. One is any further impact on FPDR due to the city charter, the city form of government change. With that, I'll probably have a new boss effective July 1, that which only impacts me. My job is to make sure it impacts nobody else, not my staff, not the members, not the board with that. And then also, we know that half our staff has now become under the CPPW union. They're going through negotiations now. And when that contract is finalized, we will share with you how that would require us as managers to change our approach to how we manage and use our staff. Because they right now, they are salaried employees. I'm certain they're going to go into a process to where there will be overtime, or it won't technically be overtime. It'll be time in excess of 40 hours is the term that they'll use to pay, and also some more control of how tightly their schedules are done. We do have a lot of flexibility now. Should we have a lot of work, we can move things around. We may lose that. So we'll share that with you, how it goes forward and what impact, if it does have to the fund or potentially to our members or even the budget. That's everything I have.
There we go. Thank you, Sam. That's a lot of squishy things coming up in the future. So we look forward to being kept updated on those. Any other miscellaneous topics for the good of the order today? All right, then. I think I will officially adjourn us. Thank you very much, everyone, for your time and presentations.
Thank you for your patience while we work through all the technical issues.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, everybody. Oh, the echoey thing.